So Lisa sent me an article from the Washington Post, a really nice interview of Lisa, and you can find it on the Washington Post. But it reminded me, because I was actually going to look up the date, that this is our 30th anniversary together.
If I had just married Barbara. I mean, is this working, do you think?
Yep.
Yeah, that's where I went wrong.
That's right. Absolutely.
Among the many choices I made that were wrong, that was the wrongiest.
So Lisa and I actually met in the bathroom of the New York Sheraton on 6th Avenue when Lisa and Dana Stabenow and I don't remember the others were nominated for an Edgar for Best Paperback, wasn't it?
Best Paperback Original,
right?
Yeah.
And Nevada Bar was up for Best First Novel.
Right.
And by a fluke, all four of us were in the bathroom together. And that's where Lisa and I first met. Now, that year, Dana won, but the next year, Lisa won.
Yay!
Yeah!
And you know, I have to say this when I come here, and those of you who have been before, you've heard me say this, but I can never let a time go by without telling you how great Barbara is. You know that because you know her and you support this store and you support her.
Oh, that
but
is so
I have
nice.
To tell it from the beginning author, strugglingly, unbelievably broke single mother. I had roots they were felony level roots. Like I'd been in prison forever. You can't imagine what it's like. I was in debt. I was trying to make a career of it. I got published in paperback because I couldn't get a hardback deal.
And here it is.
One day I answer the phone, and it is this amazing woman, who, among her many abilities, as you know, was a lawyer, and I was a lawyer, nowhere near the lawyer she was, and she called me, and I can't even tell the story, and just said, I just want you to know I'm a bookseller in Scottsdale, Arizona. I've never been in Arizona. I mean, and said, I really love your book. It just meant everything to me. It meant everything to me. So I guess what I want to say is this, that the kindnesses of people that you won't know about, I'm so happy that I get to come here. And I have to let me make that statement every year because that's the kindnesses that you don't know about. And here I am with her support and your support 35 years later with a real job. And I got lowlights and highlights. So I paid for it all.
It's only 30 years. Let's not age us anymore than we need to. So Patrick has acquired, look at this, a pristine copy of Everywhere That Mary Went, and then the Edgar winner, Final Appeal. And they are for sale for an outrageous price.
What, like $2.99?
No, it's a lot more than that.
For real?
But, oh, yeah.
I'll buy them from you.
No.
I don't even have them.
Well,
how do you? I don't have it. You have it.
Well, you can talk to Patrick about it. I will keep them up here. I was demonstrating rather than selling. But here's the thing, and you know, as long as we're going to say good things here, I'll wind up with this one. This is a bookstore that I run as a not-for-profit. I do this for fun. And the staff would like it to make a profit, right, Patrick?
I know.
Exactly. And so as a result, most bookstores were not interested in having events or being nice to authors whose books cost $7.99 because there just wasn't any money in it. So Mark Greaney, who started The Gray Man, you know, we've been together the whole time. Lisa and I have been together the whole time. You have to invest, you know, in people that you think are talented and write wonderful books. And you actually have to read the book in order to do that. You can't just take somebody else's word for it. But I am so happy that we have been able to do that over the years. And, you know, this form of publishing has practically gone away now.
Right.
But it was, 30 years ago, this was a really major thing to get a paperback offer.
Right. I mean, well, for me, it was a dream come true because your name is on the cover of something and you just told a story about an Italian girl in South Philly and you didn't, you know, and you could actually make a living and raise your kid and support your kid. But, oh, I can't, I'm too overcome. I have no estrogen left and I can't even, it's leaking out of my eyes. It's
Right. Lisa's been on tour, and that is exhausting, but she had an afternoon at the Four Seasons that I hope was
restorative. Yeah, it was
tough. Right. And we're going to go out and drink afterwards, so that'll get us both.
But I think, I think what's really well taken about your point is what I love about our business and I love about books is that it is all substance. It just is all substance, no BS. So some lady in the middle of Arizona is going to read your book and go, hey, maybe you have talent, you can do this, and it means the world to you. And I remember coming out here and there were three people here, and then there were five, and then there were seven, and now we are just a wonderful group, and I feel like I do know a lot of you. I'm pretty sure I have an ex-husband or two here, so I've actually slept with all of you. No. Oh, wait, this is we tape this, right? Damn it.
It has to be the first or second husband because her third husband's going to be a dog. So we already know that.
Anyway, so that is the great thing about books, that you actually...
So wave to the virtual audience because they're out there too, rooting
for you. Hi, guys.
I know. It's wonderful. So we're here to talk about the truth about the Devlins. But since Lisa was not able to be here for loyalty, I thought we might talk about that for a moment because that's really... a book of her heart in many ways. And it has, I mean, Sicily is, wait, you know what? After reading it, we decided, and we're doing this, not this way, but next May, we are going to Sicily.
Nice!
You inspired us to go.
Oh, great. Well, it's the only place you haven't been, so there is
that's part of it, but I know.
I've been to Atlantic City and Scottsdale. You've been to Russia, China,
Did I ever tell you that when Dirk Kessler wrote the first book after his dad died and came here, and, you know, the Clive Kessler things are all about the ocean, right? So the book starts in Tibet. And I said to Dirk, what? Why are we in Tibet? And he said, I thought it was the only place you hadn't been.
Right, exactly,
exactly. It was so much fun. But anyway, loyalty means a lot to you, and there's much to learn from it. Aside from the story, there's much to learn from it about the roots of the mafia. And so tell us about it.
Well, I think what happened, probably as I got older, see if I can even do this, that it started with Eternal a little, because you know that I identify with being Italian very much. You have to if you have a nose this big. You have to cop to it right away. My mother always says we get more oxygen than anyone in the room, and she's kind of right. But so I guess I started thinking with Eternal. I sort of wanted to, I got older, I wanted to answer questions. And one question that I wanted to answer was, why did Italians follow Mussolini? I mean, I'm just going to be real with you. I was ashamed of that. And I am ashamed of that. So what was it that, you know, what was it? What was his appeal? And the trope that he made their trains run on time, the more research I did, the more I learned was that was not true. Because if you've been to Italy, you know nothing runs on time. Nothing will ever run on time. They care about pasta and love. It's all about carbohydrates or sex. That's it. And I think in a way, loyalty was a little bit sort of the follow-up, because I kind of wanted to answer the question, too. Why is the mafia Italian? I mean, it was weird in my old lawyer days, you know, when you have a name like Scottolini and the joke is always there. Like, I was a civil lawyer in a big firm, but it's always like, are you kind of mobbed up? Do you know organized crime? I'm like, well, my family's a little sketchy, but their crime is actually disorganized. So it's, and really there was a lot of that. I mean, part of it was, I started to look at old pictures, which is another thing that old people do. And I started to look at pictures, and I saw, for example, I remembered a Christmas where I got a black BMX bike that was a boy's bike. Do you remember boys' bikes and girls' bikes? Yeah. They make no sense. Because if you ask me, the boys' bike should, right? Like, the boys don't want the high bar. The girl, I'm not a biologist, I'm telling you. And in any event, I remembered the Christmas I got the black BMX bike from my Uncle Mikey. And I looked at it in the picture, because I secretly thought, I was disappointed, honestly, because what little girl wants a black bike that's a boy's bike? Like, you want pink. So I remember, at some point, talking to my brother, and I said, I wonder why Uncle Mikey gave me that. And he said, well, what they always said was it fell off the truck. Right. Now, and then I remembered that all of the presents from Uncle Mikey were never wrapped, and they all fell off the truck. And it wasn't until I was watching The Sopranos, seriously, this was like 10 years ago, that they said that, and I was like, So my parents were basically receiving stolen goods for Christmas. And not only that, this is the part that kills me, they weren't even wrapping it. I'm like, that's the part, Barbara. I'm like, if I re-gift a book or something, which I occasionally do, I'm going to take off like 2K and with my 2 Susan, like a modicum of effort. And there was all that kind of stuff. Like, I looked at other pictures, and it was a wedding, and everybody was dancing, and they all had purses. They all were dancing with their purses. And I said to my cousin, why are they all dancing with the purse? And they go, you don't leave your purse at the table in this family. And it was one thing if then all the memories came back. I remember one more story. Where I am, so I would grow up and be on the straight and narrow. Good girl, take Latin in school, get good grades, behave yourself, wear braces, read way too much. There is no such thing. And then I went to Penn, University of Pennsylvania. I met a guy who was a Metagon, which is, do we have any Dagos in the audience? Come on. That is American. That's how we say American. When I grew up, my mother would always say, those are like white bread was Metagon bread. I didn't even know what she was saying till I realized she was saying American. And I'm like, we're American, Mom. It's very confusing. In any event, I meet a guy at Penn, and I bring him home to South Philly to meet my cousin Sonny and cousin Jimmy. And I say, this is Joe. He went to Penn. And they said, oh, which one? Because that's when I learned that Penn stands for penitentiary. I never see Joe again. Mr. Real red-haired and freckles. And I just thought, what is it about my family's... Look, when I became a lawyer, they all were like, you know, can you plea bargain for me? I'm like, what? I had no idea that there was so much criminality in my family. And I wanted to really explore that. Like, I just have to say, it can't be in our DNA, right? Like, it can't be in our DNA. So there has to be, and you end up having some very, it sounds more boring this way, but what are the conditions that give rise to crime? Judge, you know what I mean? There are experts who will look at that issue. But I had to try to figure it out for myself when I started in Sicily, because the food is amazing. But that's the short answer. It's all Uncle Mikey's fault. I just thought he was super lucky. Like, he's always driving behind these trucks in the back. So he's just catching everything. Everything he's catching and giving it to me.
So what about lemons? Because lemons are a significant part.
Right. Well, so Sicily, I confess my ignorance, right? I always thought Sicily was kind of like Italy. There's a great quote by Goethe. And he says something like, you know, if you don't know Sicily, you don't know Italy. The fact is, they're really different. Do anybody Sicilian here? Yay! Right, so Sicily is in the middle of the Mediterranean. It was a really valuable trade route. This starts to sound like sixth grade at some point. But basically, it was colonized over and over and over again by lots of different people. And it isn't really Italian per se. It's its own thing. It has its own language and its own culture. And it ends up being a sort of a really interesting way for people who, like us, who love books about justice. You know, like people say these are books about crime. I think they're kind of books about justice. And when you start to see what happens when something is colonized, especially like the way it was in the 1800s Sicily, the law benefits the rich people. This will have no relevance today. The law, right? If you really start to understand what makes law and how does law benefit people and who does law benefit. And in Sicily, it benefited the colonizers and the poor people were left out. You couldn't even own land. It was completely feudal. Long story short, do I ever have a long... Can I ever tell a short? It'll be 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock. Anyway, the lemons come in because the Arabs who cultivated... Sicily is very, very dry. It's a desert. But the one area that was irrigated by the Arabs. And those irrigation canals still exist. And they irrigated Palermo, which is the capital of Sicily. And because Palermo was lush and fertile, it could grow lemons. And then what happens is what you learned in seventh grade. Do you remember the British Navy? Do you remember they got something called scurvy? Exactly. And what's the cure for scurvy? Lemons, citrus, and that's about what happened. The British Navy figured out, wow, if we just eat lemons, our teeth won't look like shit, and so let's start eating the lemons, but they're all grown Palermo. Lemons become an unbelievably profitable crop. And then what happens is, so then they hire peasants to guard the lemons. Now, the peasantry can't move up. Sicily is illiterate and backward as they come, and the law oppresses them. And the police are completely corrupt and in with the cops, in with the nobles. So in that situation, you start to see the formation of the first mafia family. And that's really what happened, because they became the armed guards for the lemons. And at some point they said, I have an idea. Why don't we have, you can, basically the first protection racket. So in other words, go to the nobility and say, I'll tell you what, let's protect the lemons from me. And that's what they do. And that's really how it began. And I could tell you the more boring details of the law. There was even legal changes that affected it. They were supposed to liberalize buying land, but it in effect created this situation. And so that's how mafia families were formed. And it was really interesting to me to sort of, and you do see analogies. Every time there's a justice question, every one of these wonderful books, I love this bookstore so much. Don't you just love being around them? Every single one of them will have some kind of question of law and justice, and how law will sometimes lead to justice depending on how much dough you have or what kind of lawyer you can hire, or if you're black or you're white, or all of that stuff. To Kill a Mockingbird is the first book that says, hey, you might have a different result depending on who you are. And but all of those questions of when law, what interests me finally is when law not only doesn't lead to justice, but thwarts justice. And that happens. That happens in Devlin's. It happens in Eternal. Eternal is a story of basically what happened to the Jews of Rome. And what the fascist laws enacted by Mussolini did, his was the first fascist party. So we give him that credit. And he basically enacted laws that perpetrated anti-Semitism. So it's not only, it's not that it's unlawful, it's actually lawful. So Jews are thrown out of businesses, professions, schools, can't teach. Eventually divested of property, eventually, an interesting thing about Italy was the Jews joined the fascist party in the same proportion as Gentiles did. So then Jews are thrown out of the fascist party and ultimately stripped of their Italian citizenship. You couldn't be Jewish and Italian. It's horrifying. All perpetrated under color of law. And so that's what's interesting in loyalty. That point is a kid's kidnapped in the beginning. And it's those kidnappings, they happened all the time. And it wasn't like in 24 hours where it was, we're going to have your kid and he's going to grow up in a well and we're going to keep an eye on him. And we'll send you an ear. We'll send you his little finger. The kidnappings lasted forever because the police were in cahoots with the people who are doing the kidnapping. And there's no one to fight for this kid except a lawyer. I'll end this in a minute. I get so excited. Because what I found when I did the research going to this church in Sicily was that there's actually, and I think this is sort of the uplifting part of it, that there really was a group of nobles. They're just guys, judges, lawyers, doctors. They were the nobility. They benefited from all of the laws. However, they thought it was wrong. They didn't like the corruption in society. It bothered them. They were called the Blessed Society of St. Paul, the Beate Pauli. And they really existed. And they got together and they solved crimes. And they would be the people who would save this kid. And it was interesting to me too, because think about it if you're reading. What is the purpose of law? To me, it gives us, it saves our lives. We don't kill each other, right? Your neighbor's tree goes on your land. You want to go over with an act. You can't. You got to sue him. You got to do this. Law is an order, gives us an order so that we are civilized and we don't harm each other. It's the opposite of violence. Rule of law or fight makes right. Well, what happened in Sicily is that might was ruling, right? It's just these people. I forgot what I was going to say about that. Oh, but in the absence of law in Sicily, people made law. And the law they made or they found was in their religion. Religion's just a rubric, right? The Ten Commandments are rules. Here's the things that you should do. If you do these things, you're not going to hurt each other. And so these Blessed Society of St. Paul, now listen, I'm a bad Catholic. You know, I used to say, I told my daughter we were a lapsed Catholic, and she thought I said collapsed Catholic, which is really what we are. But when I started to read about St. Paul and just go, this is a beautiful, here's the one law that you need to know. I have to change my life. Do every act with kindness. Not just some acts, not the big acts, every act. It's really hard. And that's what St. Paul was about, the collective good. And what I thought about, and that's what's at work in loyalty, is that in the absence of law, when law is not there, there are other ways we will look, other rubrics for us to find a way to behave. And the Ten Commandments is pretty handy. And so St. Paul's idea was for the collective good, work for the collective good, be kind, be loving, do good for others. It's not just about you, bucko. And I kind of loved it. So I was a little swept away by, as you see, I'm easily swept away. I wake up swept away. But that's all that's operating in it. And in Devlin's, that happens too. And Devlin's is kind of twisty, so I don't want to give too much away. But there, you can see when you read it how law is thwarting justice to a certain extent. Also, in what happened to the Bennetts? Maybe we should talk about that for a minute, because I don't want to. I'm not spoiling the new book. But here's a good example, right? So, opening of what happened to the Bennetts, horrible botched kidnapping goes completely wrong. Also, when you're writing these books, I'm just me, right? You know me. I'm just a lady in the Philadelphia suburbs in front of a computer with a couple of dogs and a cat who ignores me every effing day. this cat is going to turn 17 next month, and every day I feed her, and every day she looks at me like, do I know you? And I go, can I pet you? No, you can't pet me. Sorry. I digress. Now I forget what my poet was. Oh, when you are living in the times we're in, which have so much agita and dissent, and the images of justice are so thwarted, and institutions are failing us, and all the, you know, the stuff, the everyday headlines, you can't write it straight. You can't do Perry Mason anymore. Law isn't always going to lead to justice. And your heroes have to be different. And a little bit, Bennett's really, I think, started me thinking about that. Because the first thing that happens, Bennett's, is the carjacking goes wrong. There's two carjackers. And as soon as they carjack this couple, and then, unfortunately, something terrible happens to the daughter, the one carjacker shoots the other. You know me. I don't plan anything in advance. I'm sitting there going, that's not a bad idea. And then I started to realize it in what that book is a lot about is good bad guys and bad good guys, because it isn't so cut and dried anymore. And the justice question, for example, in Bennett's is this. Let's say there's someone who dies. In the family, somebody dies. The family is put into witness protection, which is really designed for criminals and not normal people who want to be on Facebook. It's not working for this family at all. But in that situation, the FBI makes a bargain. I feel like I'm not going to tell more because I'm spoiling it. But the idea is that the institutions can make deals that would be just and further the interests of the institution, but not further your interests as the victim's family. All of those justice questions are in all of these books, and they usually end up with law somehow thwarting a just result, which isn't what we learned in law school. And makes me sad, but is interesting, and also will give you a really good car chase at one point. And really, it's exciting, but it's also true. You guys are so sophisticated now. Not only are you the crime fiction, you're crime fiction experts in this store, and that's all there is to it. She curates for everybody. I walk out of here, what do I read? She tells me what to read, and I get it, and I read it. She's put me onto the bed. It's true. You know that's true. But I mean, when you're writing for such a sophisticated group and for such a group that is so aware of modern day views of law and justice, you have to keep it real or it won't be effective.
But you also, you're really interested in family dynamics, as we've already discussed. So this book is a lot about that.
Right. I think, look, for me, it really is a lot about family. It always is. The strongest emotions are going to be about family. And I also wanted to look a little bit. I started with Devlin's. Here's what happens on I started with Devlin's because of this turbulence I'm talking about. And it raises a question of what is a hero, right? He can't be. Take a second and think about The Firm. John Grisham, wonderful book, great movie. Tom Cruise, I love Tom Cruise. I don't care what anybody says. He jumped off a mountain in the last movie on a motorcycle. What more do you want from this man? And they didn't even give him an Academy Award. I was like, Jesus Christ, lighten up. I can't believe it. I'm like, all right, anyway. Mitch McDear in The Firm, remember? Mitch McDear is a straight arrow. He has not a moment of self-doubt. He is a high achiever. His only flaw is that he's a little ambitious. Remember yuppies? He's kind of a yuppie. That's a hero for the 80s. I don't think, at least I can't write that hero now. I don't even know who that guy is. We're not, that isn't these times. And I started to think about, really, how do I feel? And I guess COVID affected me very profoundly. I have family members who, I lost family. I have family members who have long COVID and struggle. I've seen what we all went through as a country. And I felt like we're in recovery. And I said, I want to do a hero in recovery. TJ Devlin, in this book, is a recovering alcoholic. And he's even been in prison. Because also the other thing is, for me, in my life, maybe when you get to be 68, you'll experience this great thing. Absolutely nothing, except you just keep breathing. That's the key. But that the world does things to you. Bad things will happen to you that are extrinsic. You didn't cause it. It happened to you. Oh, shit, somebody hit your car. Oh, you got sick. Oh, whatever, right? Oh, let's just think of a hypothetical. Your second husband turns out to be a total asshole. Okay. It's just a hypothetical. Thing two. I mean, total asshole. You go, what was I thinking? Now, that's what happens is that is in the category of unforced error. Right? I wanted to write about not the extrinsic bad things that happened, the things I did to myself. Here's me walking down the aisle the second time. Ready? Ready? I don't know if this is such a good idea. I really should be going this way. But I went this way thinking, Lisa, you didn't think this through. Now, that would be me. So I wanted to write that guy. I wanted to go, look, we get in our own way sometimes. We screw up. But I'm a big fan of people who screw up. Because we're going to screw up. And we ought not to try to be perfect. So here's the story of TJ Devlin. He has screwed up, but he's in recovery. He's taking responsibility for it. And in the first page of this book, here's the Devlin family. There's five members, a husband and a wife. They're all lawyers, so you can really hate them. No, but they're good people. Well, you'll see what you think. There's a husband and a wife. There's an oldest son who is the golden boy, John. Great grades, did all the things, great. We love him. He's going to take over the firm. The middle child's a girl. She's kind of a public interest lawyer. And then there's TJ, who's the baby of the family. Good looking, actually hot as hell. I have a huge crush on this guy. Sadly, he doesn't exist. Yeah, I know. But here's my crushes. Bradley Cooper and a fictional character. It's not good. It doesn't bode well. And basically, in the first page, I think it's the first page, TJ Devlin is taken aside by his older brother, John, the golden boy. And golden boy says to this ne'er-do-well son, listen, I got to tell you something. I killed somebody, and I need you to help me bury the body. And I thought to myself, all right, right there, it's a little like Bennett's in that it's a reversal. That's not what you expect. Wait a minute. TJ doesn't expect it. He's like, wait, what? You're the good one. You don't kill anybody. Of course, that's why the good one comes to ask him what I would do with the body, because he's the one who would know. And he has a good sense of humor. I liked him. So really, that's what gave rise to this book. That feeling of in recovery and the feeling of how do you get out of it? How do you find the strength to go forward? I think a little bit all of these books, at least for me, end up being a little bit of a pep talk. Like, yeah, you can do it. Whether it's get through World War II in Rome or, you know, save a kid in loyalty or try to figure out what is going on in your own family, which, believe me, if you knew the Scottolini's, it can be a bit of a mystery. And so that's really what was operating, was really taking it back to basics and fundamentals that are bedrock, dramatic issues, and seeing if this character, TJ, could redeem his life. And that's a hard thing. I'll say this, and Am I going on and on? Yes, I am going on. I had Dunkin' Donuts coffee before I came, and now you know what. Let me just say this. It happened to me at the end of Eternal. This is really what I think everything I write is about. I realized it the other night. At the end of Eternal, we have gone through World War II in Rome, and people have died, because I'm not going to whitewash anything. And at the end, there's a wedding, and a character who hasn't spoken much. Well, there's not everybody left to give a toast. She has to get up and give a toast, and she's not used to speaking in front of people. So she gets up, and I'm like, Lisa, you're going to get fired, because the reader's not going to know who she is. She hasn't said anything. And then I just said, well, lean into it. Be her. So she gets up, and she says, I never am out of the kitchen. I'm either in the kitchen of the apartment, or I'm in the kitchen of the restaurant. I'm not used to speaking at weddings. And I see this table, and I see all these lovely faces at the table. But I started to feel me lately and go, all of us who are of a certain age, we have missing seats at our tables on holidays. My mother passed away on Palm Sunday. Not this Palm Sunday, but every Palm Sunday. I feel it. And we never stop seeing those missing seats. It doesn't, so that very much becomes bittersweet. Not the worst thing in the world. Have your emotions. It's the stuff of life. You're going to cry a little, and then the world won't end. But you're also going to feel the happiness. And she looks out at the table, and she has that feeling. She says, I see people, that beautiful young people that I love, but I see missing seats. And it reminds me of every night. I thought, what would she say? Well, she's a housewife who cooks. She said, well, every night I have to make a dinner for my family. And every night I go to the cupboard, and I see some ingredients I need, but I don't see all the ingredients I need. I'm always missing something. I'm missing nutmeg, I'm missing oregano, I'm missing basil, but I have to make a dinner. And I say to myself every night, what can I make with what I have? Right? And I thought, that's a really interesting question. And it looks like a humble housewife kind of question, but it's actually really a profound statement of what is the quintessential survivor question. How do you survive? And all of us have had our own share of shite, right? I mean, whether it's illness or loss or COVID or someone hits your car or you marry the wrong guy. We have to, so what we don't just stop. We're so strong and we're so resilient, and the source of it is very humble. The source of it is, what can I make with what I have? And for me, it inspired me, and a little bit it led me to TJ Devlin, because he is doing that every day. He's ashamed. You know, it's a culture that's really tough on, I think it's very tough on a lot of people, but it's really tough on men. He feels unsuccessful. You know, he's been in prison. No one's going to give him a break except for his family. He's down. And he is struggling for acceptance and respect, and above all, self-respect. So he keeps going forward. And I didn't, you know me, I don't write with an outline. I'm like, ask me if I know how it ends. And I'm going to say, I don't even know how it middles. And you're going to go, holy shit, get a real author in here, because this woman's like winging a whole career. And I kind of am. I don't know what to tell you. But that's what's behind the book. And so in a way, I've just English majored myself, I guess. But thematically, I think that's what's going through it. I'm trying to convince myself that we can go on and look at the strength in all of us. I mean, I've known, oh my God,
You haven't mentioned, I was looking up to see how early in the book the first betrayal comes, and I didn't quite see it, and I probably shouldn't tell you. But TJ's road to recovery is thrown a real curve in a very unexpected way. And that made it even harder for him.
Well, you know, it's interesting because so you have to do your research, right? And I love that part because you're trying to inform everything. And the research I did for this was fascinating because first off, we all have phones. If we're lucky, there's an app for Alcoholics Anonymous now. You can go AA meetings near me, and you can attend them on Zoom, which is what I did. There are public and non-public meetings. So you go on Zoom. I kept my screen dark. My name's not there. Just said Lisa. And I went to, at least 35 AA meetings. Wow. Well, look, I've had 10 years of therapy. That's why I have it so together. But I will tell you, it was like, it is therapy. It is everything wonderful you would want. Because I also studied about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a friend who's in recovery. And everyone, first things you learn are the stuff you kind of know. But it touches everybody. It touches a whole family. And when you're in these groups and you see people get up, and it's even more real and more moving than you see it in the movies. Somebody's going to get up and they're going to say, this week, like they say, pick up. You pick up the lingo. Pick up means start drinking again. I wanted to pick up so bad. My kid did something. And they're telling a story that is, they're full of shame telling it. They're crying telling it. And AA is a group that is completely people helping people. It's a community, in other words, like this one, right? I really love community. I love when we help each other because we have so much in common. And this group has a shit ton in common. And they're all, to a certain extent, outsiders vis-a-vis other people. They need to help each other. It's a tenet of the program. So when you listen to these, to the people in the group, I betrayed none of their confidences. But you learn how families, you know, it's an issue. Does the mother in this book, who I love, I mean, I love these characters. I think they're flawed in some ways, but they're lovable. The mother in this book is, does she help him too much? Does she enable him? You know, that, if you've ever been touched by addiction, your family and I have, you don't know what the hell to do. You just go, I love this person and I'm going to try to help. And then you're going to give money and that's going to be the wrong thing. And they're going to, you know, we just don't know. We don't know anything. And so I really wanted that. So it is, there are betrayals in this book. Families make terrible, terrible mistakes. And we all make terrible mistakes. It's really a novel that explores how deep can our mistakes go and can we really get out of them? And how can we love each other through them?
DJ is a very interesting hero.
Thank you.
So we're following his path through the book,
right,
hoping that it will come out well for him.
Right.
And sometimes the people that love you do the wrong thing to help you. So I told Lisa, because she hadn't heard about it, how many of you have read the investigative reports about the Gilbert Goons? Most of you probably have, right? And what you know is that bad parenting can seem like it's good parenting, but it turns out to be really bad parenting in the sense that you can excuse your kids. And so if you have a child like CJ Box, hello. I'm used to CJ. TJ is another step for me. But anyway, you know, if you have a child like that, what's the parent supposed to do? Is the parent supposed to be strict? Is the parent supposed to throw them out? Is the parent supposed to coddle them? And, you know, and if you have a good child and a difficult child, do you treat them the same? Or, you know, I mean, there are certainly cases in families where a responsible child winds up parenting siblings,
right,
because the parents can't seem to manage,
right,
to do, or the parents are gone. They've had an accident. They died, you know, you know, whatever it all is.
I wanted to look exactly at that because I thought about my own family, you know, and so I have a younger brother. And when we grew up, my parents were very unconditionally loving. I mean, my father, I remember at a signing once, somebody came up to him. He used to come to my signings, and somebody said to him, you must be so proud of her. And he said, lady, I was proud of her the day she came out of the egg, which was really true. And I felt it. Here's an amazing thing I remember. My mother said this. Now, this is going to sound a little grandiose, but this is my mother. Do you remember the New York World's Fair? Okay, this is only in the 60s. Well, we were going to go to that, my brother and me and my father. My mother was going to stay home. She doesn't like it. It's a long story. But anyway, we're going to the World's Fair. I was very excited because I had heard about this mythical place, New York. And I said, Mom, I am so excited to see New York. And she took my face in her hands, and she said, honey, New York is going to see you. Now, look, it's a little crazy because I've been to New York, and it really hasn't noticed me that much. In fact, I walk around because, you know, I'm friendly, you know, and also, like, sometimes I'll see, like, an Eagle shirt and I'll go, hey, and they're on the earphones, or hi, I'm single and no one's, you know, like, but that love. So basically, we grew up in a house. We didn't really get those roles assigned. However, the world can assign roles to you. And those roles can be so detrimental. Like the roles that my brother and I eventually got was that I was the smart one and he was the cute one. Now, let me tell you, that didn't do either of us any good. Because my brother is pretty damn smart. I'm not that ugly. I mean, I was like, you know, when Funny Girl came along, like, yeah, I know, I'm like that, I'm ugly. Because you just feel ugly. I mean, so you don't really, you know, and that's what I wanted to look at a little too. These, basically because I have raised a child. And I know that that initial, what they feel your love. I never forgot any of that stuff. And those labels are so detrimental. And people do it second nature. And if it doesn't happen in the family, school will do it. It happened to my brother because he came after me. And so I wanted to look at those roles because so much of CJ... Maybe that's who I was thinking of. I love his books. So many of his wounds are self-inflicted that he has to ultimately, you don't know where you get the label. Where did you get your labels from? You think about it. You have to tell me, although I'd love to know. But, you know, where did you get your labels from? How many really were true? And that might be something that we think about no matter how old you are. He has to really think about, am I the useless one? Am I the baby? Am I the charming disappointment? You know, because it gets old, man. You can't be a disappointment forever.
But what you also do in the book, because this is a family of lawyers, the parents are able to do things for the children, plus or minus, much more powerfully than if the parents were, you know, in some other profession.
Right.
We've come back to the fact that the law can be a weapon. It can be all kinds of things. So for him to be operating in a family of lawyers who want to pass the firm down to their children.
Right.
And it is a prestigious law firm.
Right.
That ups the stakes in a lot of ways, but it makes TJ more vulnerable to either good or bad parenting.
Yes, that's true. I really wanted to look at, I mean, they got a lot of curb appeal, this family. They got a lot of money, and they're a law, and I also am interested in family businesses, because it's sort of an interest, this isn't a business, they're Devlin and Devlin, right? They're a law firm. They don't make a widget. Their business is founded on their reputation, so that when TJ screws up and goes to prison, you know, he has a good sense of humor. I think that carries the book a little bit. I hope it does, because it just came to me, like, because he's a little bit of a slacker in the beginning of his life, and he's used to laughing things off, so he uses humor a little bit as a defense mechanism. But he says, for example, when he goes in their waiting room, and it's meant to look like merry old England, because his father's a big, like, Winston Churchill fan, and they have all their framed puff pieces, and he says, you know, nobody's framed my mugshot. You know, he's hurt. And think of the responsibility, too, because I think that he's a person of such good heart that, you know, he doesn't want to let them down. He feels terribly guilty for the blow that he inflicted, not only on himself, but on his family. You know, think about that. You screw up for your family, people don't eat. You could ruin a law firm if you end up being a total, you know, a criminal. And yet they employ him. They give him a chance. He can't get a job anywhere else. But that, in a way, that makes him feel bad, too. He wants to be worthy. He works really hard. But he knows it's a make-work job that his mom got him. And he tries to be better. And I love that about him.
I do, too. I think he's a wonderful character.
Thank you.
You know, I miss the Rosano. And, you know, you've written standalone books over the years. You've written series, all the rest of it. And I'm looking at the reason those bath bombs are there. You're wondering, right?
I don't know what they are.
I think they're called bath bombs. I'm not terribly
sure. I was hoping it was chocolate.
All right, the reason they're here. No, it's not
chocolate. This is like a really big chocolate.
So it was a very nice author who came here and left me these as a thank you present. I don't have a bathtub. So I thought I would bring them tonight, and we could award them to people who ask questions, because then they'll go to a good home, right? So, but they have a really interesting scent that I could see Lisa.
Is it chocolate? Is it a chocolate scent?
What is it? No, none of it's chocolate. Forget that.
You know, I should say something about Rosado, by the way.
That's right. You could actually kiss someone. If we throw it hard enough, we're going to take out somebody in the audience.
Risotto, the whole Risotto series, first off, there is a short story that's Risotto that was nominated for an Edgar, can I just say? So next, we'll find out that I lose in 1 month. But I am going to wear my good bra to the ceremony. But Risotto has been bought for streaming.
How wonderful.
By Sundance, Skydance. Look at me not even knowing anything. Skydance Media, the people who do the Jack Reacher series. All 17 books. And so has Bennett.
So exciting.
I know. It's very exciting. It's very exciting. So maybe we'll see. I am going to write them again, by the way. I love those girls. I miss those girls. I did my little historical fiction thing. And that's why I wrote the Risotto short story, because I miss them so much. And so I'm going to get back to them. Don't worry.
Wonderful news. Yeah. All right. Maybe that now, that we're each armed. Right. Maybe we should. We're not going to throw it at you.
Yeah, we can't throw it.
When you ask the question, we'll give it to you. Why don't you open it up to questions?
I'm just so happy
and
to see
I'm
gonna you
I'm going
to
turn the air conditioning up because I made it
yes,
too cold.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. First of all, thank you for being here again.
Oh, no. You know I'm happy to, girl. That's a really good question, and I've noticed I do change character name.
You know what? You can put that in your shower, and it'll be like a shower scene.
No, it's going to be for your shower. I've already.
Or it's a re-gift.
Or you can bowl in the parking lot with it, whatever for you know, whatever you want to do.
I everything matters on a character. You know, like TJ. It's TJ, right? TJ, he's a car guy.
It's now
you
CJ.
Know, you, when you have a character, everything matters. You always go back to Nancy Drew and the Blue Roadster. You know, remember the Blue Roadster? The Blue Roadster is a great example of a telling detail. I will suggest to you because Nancy is in the driver's seat and she is going places and having an adventure. TJ's a little like that. He drives, he flips cars. He drives a Maserati that he's flipped. That's part of what he does. He buys cars and fixes them up and sells them. And he says, I put the car in cartel because they're all, you know, drug seizures. So for TJ's, so when you're really working hard, everything has to work towards who this character is, and name is the most important one. Sometimes what ends up happening, you just go with what your brain gives you. Like in Loyalty, I ended up having a lot of G names. And I had a Gaetano and a Giovanni. And then my editor said, you can't do that, people will get confused. And I'm like, no, they won't. They're both G and they might. Now that's a very Italian perspective because you go Gaetano and Giovanni are completely different names, but they're really kind of not. And I guess I could see how people could. And it was hard for me because I changed Dante. Dante in Loyalty was Giovanni. So sometimes that happens, which kind of sucks and makes me sound unprofessional. But what else is new? Why stop now? But ultimately, you conceive it all of a piece. And but I think it's good to allow yourself. Are you thinking about writing? Are you writing?
No, I just like reading your book.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. So I really do really, really rarely change names because there's so much who they are that's who they really are. When I look at Loyalty now, I'll never think of that character as Dante. I know who he is. He's Giovanni. But that's kind of crazy. But you're absolutely right about that. That is absolutely right. Yes.
I have two questions.
Yes, baby.
I don't know which one.
Here, do the two of these. Whoa.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. So here you
are. I
didn't even ask the question yet. Okay.
I'm getting rid of these things one way or another.
So you're releasing control and having your character streamed.
Talking to the thing.
Oh, okay. So you're having your character streamed.
Yeah.
Did you retain any control over what would happen when they move from being a book to
I retained the check.
Okay.
That's what
okay.
No, what it really is, and it hasn't begun production yet, but look at me. I care about everything. I'm a control freak. I'm just cute. No, he's the cute one. I'm the smart one. I'm funny about it. But they're really a wonderful company.
and I will have some role. And I think they like what it is, so they're not going to change it very much. And it's the series of books. And so I'm optimistic that we'll
they'll
be
able true to it.
I think they'll stay true to it. But you know what? Honestly, I'm willing to. They're really good at what they do. And I think part of the I have no problem delegating some things. You know what I mean? You have to be in business with people you trust and you like.
It's also a different form of storytelling.
It's a different form of storytelling. It's a different form of it's a different art form. Okay. And I love to read, but I also I watch everything on. I've seen everything on Netflix. Have you?
Sure. Yes.
Hulu, Max. I was trying to figure out how much I'm spending on these, but but I love it. So I guess to be serious, I will. I think I have some executive producer role.
Ah, there you go.
You got to wear an underwire if you're executive producer, I'm pretty sure. So I'll have some say, but I think these are really good people, and I'm excited. I'm excited, honestly, because it's a great thing. It's just kind of cool, but also I think it will bring people to the books because I wrote the books, and I care about the books, and I care about those women. I want to keep writing about them, so it'll be great.
So you're not going to get involved in casting or anything like
that? I think they'll ask me stuff. I think Bradley Cooper should be in it.
Okay.
And I think he should audition at my house. I have a special room for him called the bedroom. I'm sorry. What was your second question?
The second one. This is
I'm like making dirty jokes now. I'm like dirty granny now. It's sad, and I'm not a granny.
This is the hard one.
Okay. I hate hard questions. Okay, who else has a question?
You know.
Only easy questions, God damn it. My hot pink is my favorite color. Ask me my favorite. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. You know I'm a recovered attorney as well.
Yes, I do know that.
Okay. And when I was practicing law, I worked for I worked for a law firm. I will not say the name. But the partner in the Wilmington, Delaware office.
Ah!
Did this inspire your book? I'm asking you this.
No.
Because he committed murder. He murdered the secretary of the governor of Delaware.
So sad. That's a Capone.
And in every single news story, they never mentioned the law firm. Ever. And I kept thinking, how much money did they spend to keep this out of the news?
You know, there are actually professionals that do that. Hank Philippi Ryan's most recent book, if you haven't read it, which is really very, very good. And the woman in it, that is her job, is essentially to do celebrity spin, whatever it might be, you know, to prevent things like that from happening. I mean, we all know there's a lot more going on behind the scenes in Washington than we get to see, right?
Right.
And it's just...
You know what's the interesting thing about that case? Here's a little footnote in that case. So it was a very fancy, high-end lawyer named Thomas Capano, mm-hmm. Who murdered this very beautiful woman he was having an affair with. Right. The way they found out was because his wife suspected him of cheating and so was taping their own phone and got him conspiring with his brother to get this girl's body and put it in a cooler and dump it in the water, which is what they did.
Wow.
So yes.
Did that
that's
inspire
why I
you?
Thought.
No.
No. But that's a
no,
very
I stay
good
away
question.
From it.
You're right.
I stay,
no,
but
it's wonderful.
Yeah. And then the other piece was he was having an affair with other people and they were not young or beautiful. So it was... The whole thing was
well,
such a mess.
That makes me like him a little better. No, I'm only kidding. I mean,
all right,
he's
next
an
question.
Asshole.
Patrick, okay. Can you move the microphone in here? I'm giving you this, Patrick.
Yeah.
Who give it away,
Patrick.
One to go.
Oh. Sorry, I'll catch.
Lady in green.
Lady in green.
One to go.
We know
she
her.
She wants it.
No, there are two to go. Oh Lord.
Oh my God.
Thank you so much. Okay, looking back on your earlier books
mm-hmm.
compared to today,
mm-hmm.
how would you describe your evolution as a writer?
Well, I started great and then I got greater. I don't know. I really do. I will tell you that I really do try to improve. I really, really work really hard. I have nothing else going on in my life. I'm really celibate. Did I mention that? I start with the idea. I do 2,000 words a day till I get to the first draft end. And then I start over editing until I think it's really good. I always say, get it done, get it down, then get it good. Now, when I look back at some of my other stuff, I go, I look at everything and go, I could do this better. In the olden days when we did signings, They would have you read in the beginning. Do you remember that? Like, people would read their books?
Not here.
Thank God. I never thought, I thought that was so stupid, honestly. I saw, and people still do it. I'm like, do you realize you have an opportunity to talk to people, which they don't want to hear, but, you know, you can listen to them, or they can read your friggin' book. They're there. In any event, when I used to read the book at the signings, because that was what they had you do until I finally realized you don't have to follow any rules, I would read it, and I would change it while I was reading it. I was like, ah, Lisa, that sentence is too, that. And so anyway, I try to do my best every time. And hopefully, I still struggle. Writing is really hard. I love this job, though, and I feel so grateful for it. So I look back at those, and I try to go, you tried your best, kid. That's what you could do then. And now I'm doing more challenging things, I think, to a certain... Well, they're challenging in different ways. I was nervous about historical fiction. I didn't know if I could do it. Actually, I was pretty sure I couldn't do it. And I also thought, as a person who writes crime fiction, domestic thrillers, legal thrillers, you know, you feel like, I had a little of that feeling of, you know, in Mean Girls, when there's the cool kid table, I didn't know if I could sit with those girls. And then I said, you should just try. I mean, you're half dead. How much longer are you going to sit there and wish you could do that? And then I finally did. It turns out all those girls are really nice and they were really welcoming. So anyway, I don't know if I answered your question. Probably not. I just try really hard each time. And I think they all stand up pretty well. And it was kind of nice and affirming to have somebody come along and look at all 17 Rosados and go, we can make this a TV series. I was like, I've been trying to tell you that for 35 years. But
what if they want to move it to LA or something?
They're not. I don't know where they'll film it, but it is going to be set in Philly. Please, we got to keep it real.
Next question.
Are we out of Beth Dolls?
Nobody wants one of these, so here, baby.
I cannot. That is one the funniest go. Door prize ever, I got to tell you.
I miss the tasty
cakes. Yeah, we need the tasty cakes.
And no, Beth Bombs are yes. not nearly as good as tasty cakes.
Go, what's your question?
Since you're from Philly, I'm from Philly. I hope you watch Abbott Elementary.
Of course.
Quentin Brunson got your Bradley on her TV show.
I saw it.
You have to be next.
She has a little more pull than I do.
Well, talk to her.
That is a great show, though. That is a
one
great
more
show.
Question. Everybody's too yes, too worried about taking on my bath bomb.
You can have two bath balls. That sounds weird.
Sorry. So the Lady in Green is a debut author whose event we did Monday night for her very first novel.
Oh, tell us.
It's called Off the Air, and it's set here in Phoenix, and she won the Tony Hillerman Prize for a book set in the Southwest.
Thank you.
There it is. It's a wonderful book.
You have to sign it for me, girl.
No,
you have to sign. It can't
and
be here just to sign.
I have to say.
This looks great.
It really is.
Oh, I read about this book.
Yeah.
That's you.
That's her.
Oh, honey. Honey. Welcome to the family.
And let me
say. You got to sign this for me.
As a shout out to Christina, she comes to as many author events as her job as an NPR Emmy winning reporter allows her to do. So thank you, Christina, for coming tonight.
Christina, thank you. I am so honored.
Even better, she takes many of the photos that I post on Instagram for me.
Well, you didn't tell me you're an NPR lady. I would have sounded try to make a better answer. Sound smarter. Now I sound dumb with my NPR debut.
I don't think she's taping this. You're in good shape.
Oh, no. What a bad answer. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Christina.
I managed to not cry Monday, but now I'm crying, so thank you.
She's amazing. She makes you cry. That's how she is. She's supportive in a real way.
I know she is.
I'm still on a high from her double book events Monday and Tuesday.
Congrats.
I know.
And Tony Hillerman was so good. What an honor. Tony Hillerman is a god.
Okay, back to you, Lisa. So
that was just like on TV. Wait, that's called a throw, right? Did you just throw it to me? Back to you, Kurt. Back to you. Tell us about the weather this weekend. Can you do that? Can you talk the dirty talk for us?
No.
Come on, Christina.
No,
I love
no.
that.
What was I going to say? Oh, here's my question.
Okay.
I always read acknowledgments first, but I started to read yours here, and then I was like, ooh, I don't think I should. Can I or no?
First off, I love that you read acknowledgments. Do you guys read acknowledgments?
I read them every time.
I read them every time, too. And I got, when I just started, you don't know what the rules are, right? You don't know if there are any rules. You spend your whole life going, I can't do this. It's not the rules. And you realize, screw it. I'm going to do it and see what happens. And in the beginning, I didn't understand why everyone's acknowledgments were so short. It would be like a list of names. And my first novel, I just, this is your chance. And then they said, your acknowledgments are too long. You have to cut your acknowledgments. I said, this is a thank you part, guys. And then I didn't listen. So in any event, and then I just stopped listening altogether. I think acknowledgments really matter. Right? What? Why do they matter to you guys? Why does it matter to you?
It's a connection.
Yeah, it is a connection, Missy.
Well, you're exploring the community, or you're delineating the community, as well as thanking people. But I always read them last, I think, because sometimes there are things in the acknowledgement that may give away part of the book. So in answer to your question, I would read it afterward.
Thank you. What Barbara said. She's going to answer all my NPR questions now. I agree with that, but sometimes I'll say at the beginning there's no spoilers. Interestingly, sometimes when there's, for example, there's a factual underpinning to one of the subplots in this book, which actually involves a really kind of horrific thing that happened in Philadelphia during the 60s. They basically were permitted to do medical experiments on Philadelphia prison inmates at 7 institutions. It's kind of our chapter, like Tuskegee. You know, it was really bad. And it's acknowledged that it happened. Nobody disputes that it happened. And since then, it was conducted by the University of Pennsylvania. And the city has apologized. Penn has apologized. All these people have apologized. But no one has offered any money in terms of reparations to the families of people who were experimented on and in some cases got cancer because the thing they were experimented on was an ointment at the time, which was developed by a dermatologist. And the ointment became Retin-A. And Renova, do any of you use that nice thing? Those drugs, trentinuin, all of those compounds that now nice middle class ladies use to smooth out our wrinkles and exfoliate, were tested and developed on the backs of underprivileged and minority inmates in the Philadelphia prison system. It's unbelievable. So when I've always known about that, I use it as a subplot. That's the kind of stuff I've started to use the acknowledgments for, because you want to bring something to light, and and also separate fact from fiction. What I learned from writing historical fiction is that to a certain extent, all of these distinctions and genres are a little bit of an illusion to me. It becomes a story set in, it becomes a difference between substance and form. A story set in Rome about family injustice is not so different from a family set in Chester County, book set in Chester County, Pennsylvania, about family injustice. So that's a long way of saying fact and fiction differentiated in acknowledgments sometimes is interesting and fun to do. But Barbara's absolutely correct, as in all things. Sometimes it can be a spoiler. Usually I'll warn you.
She's not nearly this deferential when we're alone.
That is so not true.
One more.
Oh my God.
One more.
Yes,
there it is.
In the back.
Yay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I went on too long.
Sorry.
I thought we had no more questions, or I would have. Go ahead. Go. Somebody go. We'll do all. Okay. Get you both in.
This isn't a question. I like the acknowledgments because you become aware that the writer doesn't do it alone.
Yes.
That there's many people that are involved in getting a book done.
That's true. You get a lot of research. Although you are the one that sits your ass down and writes it. Just saying.
Yes.
Go ahead. Just say it. Yell it out.
Not as fancy of a question, but are you going to write any more books with your daughter, Francesca?
My mom and I,
when she would drive me up to college, we would listen to you and your daughter, you guys would narrate your own books.
Right, right.
And then we'd listen to it together up and down, because I went to school in Prescott, which is about an hour and a half away.
Aww.
And so we'd listen to your books, and that was our special bonding time.
I really appreciate that. And Barbara, you were so great, because you carried those books when a lot of people didn't. I appreciate that. Francesca has recently become a novelist in her own right.
That's right.
She wrote a novel called Ghosts of Harvard, and she's working on her second one. She just handed it in. And right now we're taking a break from it. If you want to still get funny stuff from me, just sign up for my newsletter. It comes every Sunday free. Oh, good. I know. Well, I got to get back to that, though. I want to get back to doing that, because that was so much fun to make those audios. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm in the classics because I'm trying to, you know, tour. Yes. One last question? Yes. I spent, I was slated to be there 2 weeks, but then my passport and driver's license got stolen. And so I ended up a few extra days, which was kind of great. It was really wonderful. You're going to love it. And I hope when you read the book, you sort of get the flavor of it, because there's so much food in the book. Yes.
Let me follow up on that.
Do ahead.
How did you spend your days?
Spend my days in Sicily? Yeah. I had a list of questions I needed to answer and places I needed to see. And actually, on my website, so what I do is I go and do research. So I go, what's Palermo look like? What are the places that would have existed in the 1800s? I film those places for my own edification. And also when I go home, I can read and go, oh, well, that's what it looked like. Because my notes, I can't read my own writing. You'll see when I sign your book. But all of those videos are on my website. So if you read these books, it's a nice companion to, you can actually go to Sicily and see those videos. They're actually incredible.
I have. Excuse me, actually been there. And one of the things that I remember about Sicily that I really loved is that you are thinking you're going to see Roman ruins, but most of them are Greek because of the sailing and the trading and so forth. There's some really beautiful, beautiful Greek ruins there.
That was incredible.
Yes, exactly. Right. So, Patrick, are there any questions from the virtual audience?
No, but I have a question.
Okay.
I know that you're a fellow animal lover. What all do you have right now? What's your...
My animal count?
Your brood, yeah.
I have two Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. They're brothers, and they're very naughty. And I have a cat, fuck the cat, really. No, I love the cat, but was that bad that I said that?
No,
I just want to...
No, I was just...
But honestly, I'm trying to get
like
the cat
that,
to love me.
Right.
I love the cat, but the cat does not love me. I actually still have, I'm down to 7 hens. So I have 14-year-old hens. I have a chicken vet, because I live on a farm. I have a chicken vet who said that he thinks I have the oldest hens in Pennsylvania. Of course they have no more eggs, neither do I. So, you know, you really are born with a certain number, and at some point, well, you're shit out of luck. And I have a new pony, I got a pony, because everyone who's 68 should have a pony, and I have a pony. Yeah.
Well, on that note, I think let's thank Lisa for coming to see us.
Thank you, you guys.
Yay. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.